Okay. So, this is, I'm sorry, Craig, we'll need to call the roll again for the record. Call it reference, please.
Yeah, sure.
I'm sorry, this is Ken Freeland facilitating the 913 teleconference for March 30, 1916. Craig, call the roll, please.
2016. So, present on the call so far, Craig McKee, Kelly David, Andy Steele, Ken Freeland, John O'Malley, Xander Arena, Rick Tuff, Robin Horden, David Cole, Dave Schlesinger, Barry Zwicker, Wayne Coffey, Jim Hufford, Bill Wilkes, Dan Hennen, and Mike Cook. So that's it.
Okay. What's next?
Yeah. Ken, where'd you go? We may have disconnected. Are you back, Ken?
He's back to 1916.
My father wasn't even born.
Yeah, I think Kitty Hawk was a few years before that, right?
Yeah.
But the Federal Reserve was only 3 years old.
Yeah, it's still not too late.
I went to a gas station and to get my annual inspection sticker, and on the reading stand there was a Life magazine copy from May 1942.
Wow! Wow!
1 month later than I was born, so I was like, "Oh, amazing to look at these things." So how much we've changed.
Yeah.
All right, Jim's back again. I don't know. My audio keeps cutting out. Can you hear me now?
Yep. Yeah. We.
I don't get it. Okay. Well, here I am again. So let's proceed then with the. Okay. We've got the roll called and.
Yep.
We have the minutes approved except for potential amendments from David Schlesinger. David, are you ready with those amendments?
I found it.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead with your amendment proposal.
Let's see. This is what I wrote. David Schlesinger offered critical comments about AE911 Truth policy of denying others access to contact information of petition signatories. Andy Steele responded on behalf of AE911 Truth. More correct would have been as qualified organizers, i.e. most trusted people rather than others, are who were being denied access to such lists to call from. Andy reported an exception, but did not deny my assertion of what was now policy. To be more
specific, there's a limit to which we go with the details of the minutes, okay?
Qualified organizers instead of others is the issue.
Thank you. Okay, that's what you're requesting. You would like qualified organizers rather than others to be the final version of the minutes. Okay, does anybody have a problem with that amendment to the minutes?
What is a qualified organizer?
AB decides who's qualified. They have their own standards. Whatever standards they want. That's always been the case.
Then say AB qualified.
Fine.
Qualified.
AB deemed qualified organizers.
Yeah.
Okay.
Fine.
Okay. So, is there any objection to substituting AE? Well, how was this stated again, David? AE.
AE deemed qualified
organizers for the others in the minutes. Any objections to that amendment? Hearing none, then we will amend the minutes accordingly. Any other amendments to the minutes? No, I guess we've already agreed that the rest of the minutes are acceptable. So,
I also correct what the notes about the discussion Wayne and I had about Bazant. It wasn't that I was going to approach Professor Bazant. It would be I would stand with a banner designed to criticize him outside of the building he has his office in. and the URL would be on the banner. So it's hardly approaching him. It is trying to organize, try to generate interest in the issue at the very large university he's near.
Yeah, but without a long, drawn-out explanation, David, can you give us substitute language you would like?
Challenge Professor Bazant at his home university.
Challenge as opposed to
approach.
Approach. Okay. So would challenge be acceptable then?
Challenge him at his home university. We challenge him all the time.
Challenge him. The words would be challenge him at his home university.
Right.
Okay.
That's good enough.
Okay. So any objection to that? A second change in the minutes. Hearing on them, we'll amend the minutes accordingly, and then we take the rest of the minutes that have already been approved. The draft agenda, I take it, has been approved. Nobody offered an amendment. We'll therefore proceed with our first item on the agenda tonight.
Hold on, Ken. The draft agenda hasn't been approved.
I thought when I dropped off it had been approved. Okay. So are there any amendments to the draft agenda?
Yes. Yes. This is Craig. I would like to propose that we give one or both of the two AE representatives on the call equal time to respond to Dave again tonight, as since we set that precedent with the last call, and that we give them the same number of minutes to divide up as they choose.
Okay, then would you like to second that amendment?
Second.
Okay, so seconded, moved and seconded to give the AE-911 Truth representative another opportunity to respond to David's comments tonight with the same amount of time. Any objections? Hearing none, then we will give them, so I guess that would be Andy Steele, right?
And Kelly David as well as on the call.
Oh, Kelly David. Okay, thank you. We'll give them the same opportunity that we had previously to respond. And then we will go on to the first, hearing all other amendments, we will take
the
amendments.
Yes, I'd like to add in the announcement section a brief description of the Massachusetts right of free petition.
That's not necessary. You'll have the opportunity in the announcement to make any announcements you wish, as long as you keep it relatively brief, okay?
Yep.
Okay. That's what amendments are. Announcements are. They're for letting everybody know what's going on in your local area or your particular agenda, okay?
Yep.
So, let's then take the draft agenda for approval with no further objections and go to the first of tonight's items. That would be bringing us up to speed with our recent member survey and how we should deal with our agenda overload, which has become very burdensome of late. And the overwhelming majority, which I would say was 75%, have said that they would like a second conference scheduled in the month when we have too many agenda items to fit into an hour and a half. So I'm just translating that into a proposal of using the second Wednesday of the month as an optional second monthly teleconference in those months where we have too much agenda for one teleconference, with the understanding, based on what some other people said, that we would prefer that any scheduled debate would be scheduled for that second teleconference to keep the regular teleconference open for shorter items. So, with that understanding, does anybody have any objection to our doing so in the future as we find the need with additional agenda items? Does anybody want to debate this, or can we take it as settled?
Just a comment and a proposal that the Boston 9/11 group has it every other Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
So if it would be nice, perhaps, if we did the second interstitial conference call with this group on, say, Thursday or Tuesday?
Well, unfortunately, Wednesday was the we did a survey of what days people prefer, and Wednesday was the biggest draw. However, can you tell me which Wednesdays does the Boston group have its meetings?
Well, it sometimes changes. We have one upcoming next month, or in a week, excuse me, because we've had three speakers. We had Chris Bolin, and we had
Okay, so you don't schedule them on regular Wednesdays, and you just have them. There's hardly any way we'd be able to plan around that, unfortunately. So I guess okay. All right, thank you. So just try to keep in mind that we may be using the second Wednesday as we need it. But we're still going to try to keep it to a monthly teleconference if we can. So if there's no objection, then that will be our procedure for the future. If hearing no objection, we'll take the results of the survey as understood as a proposal and accepted from here on forward. Okay, now the next item on the agenda is primer on serious flights focusing upon ground effect and doable airliner speed. Robin Horton postponed his presentation from last month to give us more time, and he is the first on tonight's agenda. So, Robin, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Ken. Before we start, I'll just give you a thumbnail of me. I'm a 1,600-hour commercial pilot, CFI, flight instructor, ground instructor, passed the Boeing 737 flight engineers test, and have spent 11 years as an air traffic controller. So I have, and also 2 years, almost 2,000 hours, repairing light aircraft. Most of my hours are in smaller aircraft and not turbojet aircraft, but I've studied that. I also want to just simply announce, I'm going to go really, really fast here, so if you have any notes, just scribble them down and catch me at the end. I'm going to announce that two years after I joined Pilots for 9/11 Truth in the mid-2000s, I had to quit because I felt that they were producing unreliable information, and I find this teleconference to be very fortuitous in that we have what I consider to be the most reliable group with 9/11 Truth attached behind it, and that is architects and engineers. I do not find pilots for 9/11 Truth to have such accuracy. Also, what I will say, I'm not going to be pointing fingers and naming names. All I'm going to say is that of any portal that we have across the whole swath of the 9/11 Truth research community, this pilots for 9/11 Truth is the most wide open for misinformation or disinformation, and I believe a lot of it is disinformation, which is a serious charge, because there are so many people with military flying backgrounds. So I'm not going to pick a big fight. I'm just going to give you my point of view, and we'll kind of go from there. Speeds play a huge role in the aviation events that happened on 9/11. I mean a huge role. We've got the two, we've got America 11, United 175 at the World Trade Center, and then we have American 77 at the Pentagon. I will say to you that I am not convinced that the flight data recorder nor the radar, and I've studied a lot of it, is 100% dependable, even though they look perfectly matched. Just to give you a primer on all of that data, each of those systems, radar systems and flight data recording systems, have locations that are defined by latitude, longitude, positions. Therefore, one can be made from the other. It's extremely simple. To explain this to you, I will just take you into a brief summary of war games. War games have programmers designing intruders into their NORAD systems, and the way that they write up the entire program is they say, at this lat and long, we need a primary invading target, and that it's heading in this direction at this speed. So therefore, all they do is ticky-tick, 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 and they just completely enter and create a fabrication. Okay, that's all I'm going to say on that. We've had a wide array of opinions given to us about pilots, flying, flight characteristics, etc., about all of the aircraft. What I will say to you, and this is a big problem that I have, is that an awful lot of existing airline pilots say, well, I've flown 757s for 30,000 hours, or I've flown that very aircraft for 1,600 hours, or whatever it might be. None of that information has very much to do with a good analysis of what needs to be done regarding the high-speed activities surrounding United 175 and American 77. And this is why. Line pilots who fly the airlines cannot fly their aircraft above recommended V or M. Velocity is indicated airspeed. M is Mach values. They cannot fly their aircraft above the allowed speeds. And throughout the entire presentation given to us by pilots of 9/11 Truth, they have only referred to a thing called VMO or MMO, max operating speed. VMO is below 18,000 feet, MMO is above 18,000 feet, and there's a max operating speed allowed for airline, for line pilots to deal with it. Anybody who remembers the 55-mile-per-hour restriction that we had decades ago remembers that we all had a little red line at 55 on our speedometers. That's what that means. If pilots of 9/11 Truth were as thorough as architects and engineers in doing what they do, pilots of 9/11 Truth would have put forward information that presents higher speeds allowed by aircraft. When aircraft are designed and built, they have to be test flown. And the way that you get to know which speeds are acceptable and how the aircraft flies is that you have test pilots parachute up, get up, dive, twist, turn, upside down. They ring the aircraft out, and they're all recording that information. They are discovering what the new airframe and engine relationship is going to be able to do, even at the risk of their own lives, which they're good at it now, and they know a lot. They don't lose their lives at the moment. But they push it. So, here are some speeds that are above VMO, MMO, the pilots of 9/11 Truth did not share with us. And in an email with Balsamo of pilots of 9/11 Truth, he brushed it off to say, well, that's a complete other story. Well, they're the professionals, and we need to know that other story, but we don't. So, in the FAA certification process, and you can find it on the notes here, it has Hay Flying Files V-Speeds PDF. You find several different speeds that are associated with each aircraft. I'll just go through three of them. VD, design diving speed. Why do we have a design diving speed? And each of these I'm going to mention to you is well above VMO, MMO. This is where disinformation comes in as far as I'm concerned. Design diving speed is if your aircraft is at altitude to someplace and it has an in-flight emergency, okay, deep pressurization or whatever it might be, they know how fast that aircraft can be nosed down, put up to higher speed, to get out of the super high altitude to save the passengers, and they have it and pilots are trained to do it. That's well above DMO. We have VDF slant MDF, demonstrated diving speed. That is a thing that the flight checkers and the test pilots actually get in the aircraft and actually choose to design. I mean, to find out. They push that thing over and they find out where the shake, rattle, and rolls come from, and then they know what they need to know, and all of this information is recorded by Boeing and other aircraft manufacturers. Again, this is above VMO, MMO. Then we have the final one, which is VNE, never exceed speed. This is the speed above every other speed where they have discovered that if you nose this puppy over and you go basically straight down, okay, you can go above VMO, go above all of those things, but you know what? If you go above VNE, now all of a sudden the airfoils, the wings, the tails, other parts of the aircraft are not functioning at the airspeeds that the aircraft was designed for, so you start to lose control. That's the big one, and I'll tell you, that one is way above VMO. All right, so that's a point of view. Now, other information that we've had from pilots from 9/11 Truth is that it is impossible for an airliner to fly a few feet above the ground because of ground effect. Ground effect is basically a cushion and a pillow. I'll get into that a little bit later. Underneath the wings of a moving aircraft, high speed, low speed, that because the ground interrupts the airflow under the wing, it adds air pressure under the wing and therefore increases the lift. This ground effect is absolutely real. However, some pilots say that when we are going too fast that low, we're going to go into a high-speed stall. They've never described that, what that is. Some say you can't get that close to the ground because of ground effect. Well, the truth is that airliners crash. They have got to be wrong. So how do crashes, or how would have American 77 been able to fly that low on its approach to the Pentagon? Most of us have seen Massimo Mazzucco's 3-DVD set in which he shows a military KC-135, a tanker, which is Boeing 707, flying across the desert for a few seconds, and if you do the math, okay, it's 40 feet above the ground. And that aircraft is flying at a fairly good speed, and its nose is up. That means that the angle of attack of the wing is up. That means you don't have to push it over. So that aircraft was very comfortable and easy flying just above the ground. And in fact, if it wanted to fly into the ground, it just could have nosed over and done it. Okay, there are two basic types of lift that we get. One is called Bernoulli, and the other is basically called plate lift. Plate lift is used for super high-speed fighter jets. They have wings that are extremely narrow, like a knife. And they create lift in a different way. When we're driving down the road, and we put a hand out the window, and we have it flat, we can just turn it up and down, and we get an understanding of lift. This is plate lift. This is where the pressure underneath the hand of the wing, okay, is greater than the air pressure above the wing, making the differential required, but it is done by compressing the air under the wing. Bernoulli has a different approach, and when you fly in an airliner, and you've all seen the flaps, and you've seen the kind of the thicker wings of airliners, they use Bernoulli, and Bernoulli works by having the shape of the wing, often called the cord, be such that from the front edge of the leading edge to the trailing edge, when air goes over the top, or the wing goes through the air and the air slides over the top, and then some of it slides under the bottom, in order to get to the same point that it was at the time that the wing hit the air, okay, at the point of at the tail end of the rear part of the wing, the air going over the top of the wing has to go a greater distance. In doing so, in the same set of time, what happens is that air has to speed up. And what Bernoulli discovered is when you take that air and you make it go over the wing like that at a much faster speed, the pressure in that high-speed air is less than the pressure below. So this has got to do with airfoil design, the cord. We've all seen aircraft depart and then land. We see the flaps go out in the front. We see the flaps go out, they'll go back in the rear. And all of those are designed to make the cord of the wing greater over the top than the bottom. So when we get to approach and land, or when we start to take off, what happens is, because we change the actual design of the wing, we really heighten Bernoulli's effect. So it radically changes the airspeed over the top of the wing. And so it radically allows that wing to fly at a lower speed. This is in comparison to the fighter jets, who are supersonic, but they don't even take off until they reach 250 knots, or land until they reach 250 knots or so, because they don't use Bernoulli. They use the plate effect. So in both United 175 and American 77, we didn't have any flap or leading edge extensions changing the actual cord or the shape of the wing, because they had flaps up. They were going at the highest speeds that they could, okay, and they were still operating under Bernoulli, which means that the existing kind of camelback shape of the wing was making the air going over the wing so much more so much faster that it really created a lot of lift. However, aircraft are designed to be able to control how much of an angle the pilot can command the Bernoulli wing to deal with. The best example of this can be given on a departure roll. And in the back of your mind, I'd like you to think of the NASCAR Indy racers with the inverted airfoils, which create downward pressure on the wheel. When an aircraft departs, a turbojet or an airliner departs, it puts front flaps down a little bit, front flaps down, back flaps down a little bit, not as much as when they're landing, because their objective is to speed up, not slow down. When that aircraft is accelerating down the runway, you can see that the aircraft is not nose low per se, but it's very level to the ground, if not slightly nose low to the actual cord of the wing. In other words, accelerating down the runway, they do not want that aircraft to slowly lift itself off, because there may be crosswinds, there may be other things. They need their three tires holding that aircraft, steering it down the runway, and they need pressure on them. And so here's the key about Bernoulli, and where I can kind of wrap this up regarding American 77. As the aircraft is accelerating down the runway, it reaches a certain speed, which is the velocity at which they can continue to take off even if they lose an engine. And slowly what they do is they rotate. In other words, the nose gets picked up. Now, nothing has changed in this entire scenario except for what's called the angle of attack of the wing going through the air. And what happens is, as the nose is picked up, the air impacting the wing, because of the rounded front surface of the wing, now the contact point for that air lowers on the front of the wing. In other words, by picking the nose up, you actually increase the angle of attack, meaning that you increase the distance over the top of the wing, which means that you increase the lift potential as a function of Bernoulli. Then you know full well that as you start to pick up speed, the flaps are retracted. This is all done, okay, because as soon as you pick up other speed, the natural or the actual design shape of the wing, the cord, okay, is beautiful. You're 250 knots, that wing can fly really well from there.
Robert, I need to interrupt you for a second here. We're at 18 minutes, or 19 minutes, I'm sorry. There's only 25 minutes allotted to this, including questions, so... can you make your point very quickly, you know, and leave a little time for questions?
Yes, I'm ready to move on so you understand that. So the bottom line of the story is on American 77 approaching the Pentagon, I've already expressed to you about where I feel the speeds are unrealistic. The bottom line of the story is that, and there are eyewitnesses that say that American 77 was flying slow, and it was banking left and right, and whatever it might be, okay? A complete different input and information that we have from the flight data recorder and the radar. Completely different, okay? So I've chosen to kind of look at that. Middlebrooks is the guy's name. Actually, Lagasse and other guys do it too. So the bottom line of the story is that as the aircraft approached the Pentagon on the lawn, in order to get closer, all the pilot would have to do is lower the angle of attack, lower the nose, and that would lower the coefficient of lift developed by Bernoulli. So that is the primer on aviation, on I should say on the theory of flight. If you want to do more research into this subject, please Google Air China 006. And read NTSB report, Air China 006, NTSB report, and look through it. You are all intelligent enough to make your way through, even though some of it is technical. Air China 006 lost an engine at the very top end of its envelope, super, super high. It yawed a little bit, and all of a sudden, one wing created more lift than the other. The other wing created less lift than the other, and it flipped right over and headed down. You can see in the NTSB report pictures of the 747 in a straight nose-down attitude. The speeds went radical, and the captain flying either, I think it was at night or in the clouds, the captain didn't really know and see that this had happened. And he was a little bit late to react, but he finally found what we call the horizon. He found gravity. And then, once he found gravity, he started a pull-up. The pull-up was a 5.2G pull-up of a Boeing 747 that permanently bent the wings up 3 degrees above manufacture. So that's the Morgan Reynolds and the beer can analysis. These craft are actually quite strong, and they're pretty sturdy outfits. So the reason that I am doing this is I am trying to end the presumption that whatever it is that Pilots for 9/11 Truth says should be considered as accurately as anything that comes out of the mouth of the writing for architects and engineers. They are worlds apart. So we need to be more critical about any information about that. And that's really all I wanted to say. We're operating, I think, at levels of ignorance. And I will follow with this. We all are looking into the eyewitness reports. We have eyewitnesses say 737, 757, 707, missile commuter plane. Anybody on this phone call, right here, tell me the three identifying differences that you can see between a 737 and a 757 that's flying with its gear and flaps up. Anybody? Well, I do. So even when we get eyewitness reports of seeing this, seeing that, seeing everything else, and we say, well, I saw it was a 757, or my boyfriend, it was a 757, it was this, that, and everything. I'm sorry, but they just don't know. Besides, half the aircraft sightings were directly overhead, or were miles away, or wherever it might be. But we are so needy. We are so needy and so obedient to listening to pilots of 9/11 truth and what they put out that we don't even know that we need to question that person and say, what were the three differences between? How did you know it was a 757? What were the three differences?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
That's it. We're out of time on this issue, but thank you, Robin, for that presentation. And hopefully, if anybody has any follow up, maybe Robin, you can give your, if you'd like to give your email address for the minutes, they can contact you with questions. Okay, you want to give your email address?
Yeah, it's my name, Robin Horden, RobinHorgon, at Juno, Juno. com.
One more time, please.
Robin, one word, Horden, Hordon, at Juno, Juno.com.
Okay. Thank you so much, Robin. Okay. Now, moving on.
I'd like to make a quick suggestion that all of this be put into a document and be available. It's great information. I'm familiar with a lot of it.
Mm-hmm. I'm working on that, and it's a huge document. This is only a small part of it.
Yeah,
okay.
It doesn't have to be. Yeah, you got to think layman and then maybe two versions. One
okay.
for the technical and one for the layman.
Okay, great. Well, we're out of time on this one. We need to move on to the next item. Thanks again, Robin. Now it's James Hufford's review of Paul Craig Roberts' Neoconservative Threat to New World Order, Washington's Perilous War for Hegemony. Most people know, I think, James is the coordinator for 9/11 grassroots.org, and he's been waiting for a couple of months to give us this presentation. So, James, the floor is yours. You have 25 minutes. If you want to leave time for questions, you'll keep it shorter than that. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, first of all, you're going to have to bear with me because I couldn't remember all this, so I had to write it down, and now I'm forced to read my own writing, and that's not an easy task. But anyway, the book is by Paul Craig Roberts, author that probably most or all of you are somewhat familiar with, entitled, it's an anthology entitled The Neoconservative Threat of World Order, or Neoconservative Threat to World Order, and it's published in Atlanta by Clarity Press, 2015, 402 pages, and it's an important book by a major thinker and truth teller, and as always, not published by a prominent publisher. None of the best 9/11 truth authors ever are, so that's nothing new, but the title, well, I doubt that the title was Dr. Roberts' title. Its subject actually is not a threat to world order, but an actual engine of chaos in the here and now. So it's not just a threat, it's ongoing and causing me a lot of, probably 95% of the tremendous upheaval that's going on in the world today. I always look for inclusion in the whole schema described of the Federal Reserve apparatus, and which I consider an integral part. As an economist, former Dr. Roberts definitely is, he's former Assistant Secretary of the Treasury, and also former associate editor of the Wall Street Journal, he finds that the Fed has been manipulated for nefarious purposes. For instance, he states that the Fed rigs bond and bullion markets to protect the dollar, but doesn't seem to recognize the staggering, unnecessary cost of borrowing our money supply and wherewithal to pay all of the government's obligations from the Fed as contributing to the supposed need for a perpetual war to provide, in effect, an additional economic sector benefiting only the plutocrats and pickpocketing everybody else at an extremely high rate in taxes. In other words, Roberts misses the main incentive in fact fueling the U.S. addiction to war, in my opinion. Hence, the neoconservatives that he highlights and blames are just the militaristic opportunists who have taken advantage of the desperate manufactured need for an economic boost in order to keep the financial ship afloat. The alternative being the abolishment of the Federal Reserve arrangement that has kept the plutocrats fat and satisfied. Dr. Roberts' book documents the unbelievable obsession with U.S. imperial domination expressed by the policy of determined global warmongering requiring a falsified official narrative for its justification. The arbitrary time frame highlighted in this book, which is comprised of a lengthy anthology of Dr. Roberts' published essays and op-eds from February 2014 to July 2015, 105 in all, including four that somehow he wrote or published on one particular day, focuses very largely on the long dust-up between the U.S. and Russia over the Crimea and the direction of the Ukraine. If he'd had chosen a different time frame, the content would have been different than that, but that's the bulk of the content of this particular book, with the addition of a thorough review in one article, one beautiful article, in my opinion, of the effects of 9/11. That's probably worth the price of the book itself. The main value of this sequential collection of mostly light-themed articles, other than as a historical record, is that the direction, objectives, and modus operandi of the leading edge of U.S. foreign policy are displayed in relief, placing the world-menacing duplicity and lack of straightforward candor of the U.S. and its global positioning squarely on the table. To me personally, it was reassuring to find large segments of my own view of the U.S.-Russia narrative of events as I had perceived it myself, more or less confirmed by someone with a far deeper background and more extensive sources than I have to draw upon. Thus, his work for me lent confidence to my view that gaining a fair idea of the direction and meaning of world events is far from impossible for a person without exceptional means or access. I'll just conclude by saying this is an important book for understanding the contemporary world, highly recommended, and it follows Robert's equally impressive earlier collection, How America Was Lost. And, well, that's basically it.
Well, all right. James, you gave a very succinct summary there. You left plenty of time for questions and discussion. So would anyone like to be on the stack to make a comment or ask a question of James?
Well, I'll step in here, Barry's Richard in Toronto. And,
Barry, go ahead.
Hi. I've been impressed immensely with his work and the fact that he was a Wall Street Journal editor, and he has such a grasp of American politics and the economy, give all his words extra weight. And the fact that he has seen this larger picture of U.S. hegemony and the terrible results of it is a thread and a theme through all his work. He's very courageous. And I'm absolutely delighted that there's been a review of his latest book, and also that James Hufford has done that review.
Thank you.
Thank you. Who else would like to make a comment or ask a question? Well, then I'll ask you, James, if you can possibly summarize for us the essay that caught your attention regarding 9/11. Can you tell us, you know, in so many words, what he had to say there?
Well, let's see. He wrapped up 9/11, I think, in all of its objectionable aspects. He didn't really give his own version or take on what had happened, but he cited the contributions of many of the leading researchers, many of the critical researchers into what had happened, their contributions, and how those, in his view, cumulatively reached the sort of the thinking public's perception of the whole thing, and I think he was very, he's a little bit gloomy in a lot of aspects, but in a lot of subjects, but in this particular subject, I thought that he was not so. He was surprisingly upbeat in thinking that our more celebrated researchers have really contributed to a change in the public's understanding, and pretty much wholesale rejection of the official view, and I found that very striking. He also added to that his critical view of the absolute zero credibility of the Osama bin Laden takeout story to that, and I thought that was quite interesting too. It's really an interesting article to read, and I found it the best of all of the 105 articles in the book. Although it sort of stood alone in, it was the only one that really reviewed 9/11.
Okay,
from a standpoint 13 years after the event.
I'm sorry?
Okay. Go ahead. I was going to say if there's a, I was going to say I would like to make a comment.
Who?
My name is Tim Mike.
Tim. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. So I was just, Tim Michael.
Okay.
I was struck by how, and thinking about this, of how closely American policies in the Middle East has comported to the Likud Party objectives since the 1970s. It was just incredible. It seems like almost whatever whatever plans the Likud Party has, it seems like American foreign policy is almost wrapped around that.
Well, I think that's definitely, to say the least, been a thread in formulating American foreign policy, certainly, and it's not surprising that, that there's at least an echo of Likud policy that's visible in 9/11 and subsequent subsequent events too.
Yes, I agree.
Thank you. Before we go further, has anyone joined the call who was not mentioned during the roll call that we could add at this point?
Nita Renfrew.
Nita Renfrew, thank you.
Nita Renfrew.
Gotcha, Nita. And who else?
Martin Bruce.
Martin Bruce, okay. Anybody else?
Roger Boris.
Roger Boris, okay. Who else? Okay, thank you. Are there any other comments or questions on the Roberts book?
Yeah, I'd like to make a comment, Nita. Nita Renfrew.
Nita, go ahead. Yeah, okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I said you can, an article by Guyonneau, the French author, titled Who Are the Neoconservatives? And you circulated it, and in response to what the person who just said that he was surprised to see all of the coincidences between the Likud policy and the American policy, I would recommend that everyone read that article, because it, it details why the coincidences are there, how American policy has been manipulated.
Great. Yes. Can you send the link to that to Craig so that we can include that in the minutes on this issue?
Okay. How do I send it to Craig?
Well, you can just Go ahead,
you could just send it to the general listener, but my email is Craig, C-R-A-I-G, McKee, M-C-K-E-E, 45, at yahoo.ca.
Yahoo.ca. And that's the no space or period between Craig and McKee.
Right.
Okay. I will do. I think that's the article that most succinctly sums it all.
Yes, very true. I have to agree. Right. Does anybody else have a comment or question on this issue before we move on? All right, then we'll thank James for a very helpful and informative summary of the book, and move on to our next item. That would be... Oh, boy, I'm getting an echo. Is everybody else hearing an echo?
Yeah.
Uh-oh. Nope, I guess it stopped. Radar data and drone theory on 9/11. Our newer member, Xander Arena, am I pronouncing your name correct, Xander Arena?
Yes, that's correct. Yep.
Is going to give us some tutorial on this question, and we have about 15 minutes for this, including questions and answers, so... measure yourself a quarter of the way and go ahead, Peter.
All right. I forwarded on a PowerPoint to the list, so if anybody wants to download a presentation that I'm kind of running by with some great links and other things, that would be helpful if you haven't already done so. But the guiding premise of this talk is that the 9/11 operation was a blend of both LIHOP and MIHOP, and that the only way we'll get resolution out of the movement is to recognize that fact. So we have some legitimate terrorists, we have some MIHOP scenarios going on. Pilots for 9/11 Truth have done an excellent job analyzing the flight path specifically of UA-175. and the flight dynamics of that aircraft. And that's what we're going to focus on, the UA-175. So it's a 767-200 series aircraft, purportedly, leaving Boston in the morning of 9/11. We know that to be true. The flight path basically takes it down, crosses the Hudson, and over Stort Air Base, does some little bit of deviation, and then spins back around and heads to New York City. Others have done a lot of research on Stort, and it was an interesting air base in that it was both a private and public, so there's some wiggle room in there as far as who you might assess blame to, but the idea would be that we had a co-plane scenario, so drones taking off, or at least one drone taking off from that airfield in particular, that was then utilized as an impact jet into the South Tower. So let's look at the evidence for that. A flight impacts the South Tower at 510 knots. At approximately sea level, we're talking about 1,000 feet, but, you know, given that these things are designed to fly at 35,000 feet, that's a pretty negligible difference between 0 feet and you know, 1,000 feet. The opening caller, Robin Horton, mentioned, you know, he cast some doubt on pilots for 9/11 Truth, and he mentioned that they only talk about VMO and MMO. And curiously, he neglected to speak about the equivalent airspeed, which is a very important physical characteristic of any aircraft and flight dynamics, and that's the effect, the dynamic pressure effect that would be experienced by an aircraft if it were going that speed at a different altitude. And so Pilots for 9/11 Truth do a very good job of analyzing this, and I posted also on the email forum or the Yahoo group a link to the Code of Federal Regulations, Title 14, Part 1, Chapter 1, and where it talks about EAS, so that's a legitimate thing that we got to consider. And basically, if the alleged UA-175 were traveling at 510 knots at 1,000 feet, that's equivalent to it flying at greater than 1.4 Mach, 35,000 feet. Clearly, this aircraft cannot do 1.4 Mach. Anybody with flying experience knows this. Robin should know this. All military personnel would know this. And that's another thing I just want to chat about real quick here. I was really discouraged to hear that one reason we may want to listen to Pilots for 9/11 Truth with doubt is because there's military personnel in their ranks, and I just think that that couldn't be any more treasonous to deny the veterans who have served all of us to protect us. You know, their fair hearing just because of the service that they may or may not have done and to question their motives in aligning with a professional organization. I think that I would be very cautious to cast doubt on a group simply because of military affiliation. So, moving forward, the aircraft exceeds MMO by about, I think it's 140 knots, and so that's clearly impossible. We also have evidence of the pod. That's shown in CNN footage, Carmen Taylor's footage, Evan Fairbanks' footage. We see that happening. We see a flash.
Excuse me, Taylor, excuse me, one second. Somebody is tapping on a keyboard or making some kind of a sound.
Sorry, that was me. I'll stop.
Well, you can star six will mute your microphone, and then you can continue to do what you're doing. It won't disturb the rest. Okay?
Yeah, sorry. I did.
Okay.
All right, we have the pod, and no problem, and we all know about the pod. Let's fast forward. The other thing we want to look at is using pixel analysis, you can look at images of the impact jet, and you can see that the forward section of the aircraft from the front of the wings to the front of the plane is actually longer than a 767-200. It matches a 767-300. So now we're talking freighter-class aircraft. This is a different plane. So arguments that the 767-200 couldn't break the steel shell of a World Trade Center tower, we can kind of start put casting those aside because now we have a freighter jet flying at a higher speed, delivering more kinetic energy, and unquestionably these planes were modified. And so concerns about them crashing through the exterior shell, I'm not concerned about that at all. So let's look at the co-plane. If the WTC impact jet wasn't tail number N612UA, then where did N612UA go? That's the question I started looking at. And so I was analyzing the Freedom of Information Act RAID data, and there are numerous primary signals that continue westward from the moment that the alleged UA-175 turns back to the east. So it's my argument, and it, as it turns out, as I've delved into this, others have argued the same case, and so I found a great video by somebody put up about 2 years ago on YouTube looking at the same thing. I want to give credit where it's due. That these primary returns, and also Pilots for 9/11 Truth have looked at this as well. They've located other primary returns heading west from that time that the impact jet turned off. So the only reason that our official story tells us it's UA-175 is because we assume it's UA-175 because we have a deviating primary radar return. But that primary radar return could be anything, and in fact, I think it was one thing in particular, a modified aircraft that launched from an aircraft airfield near the Hudson. And just on that note, there are a few other airfields in that vicinity, so that would require further investigation. Heading westward, ACARS data. We get the original UA-175, tail number N612UA, blipping on ACARS over Harrisburg and then later Pittsburgh. Lots of people have looked at this before. There's no way that these ACARS stations can get a transmittal receipt, an acknowledgement of their transmission if the aircraft wasn't there. So UA-175 was there. Where did it go? I put in the PowerPoint, I'm kind of estimating a 200-mile range circumference around these ACARS stations, line of sight, VHF radio. And you could have a UA-175 clicking in Harrisburg at 9:03, then clicking in Pittsburgh at about 9:23. If it were closer to Pittsburgh than it was Harrisburg, that would be the case. Just like when your phone travels to the next tower, as the next tower becomes closer, the signal is transferred to that one. Same thing here. And then looking at these flight speeds, if it was going at a moderate velocity, it could be arriving in Cleveland area around 10 o'clock, 10:10. So there are reports of multiple aircraft landing for security reasons at Cleveland Airport on 9/11. And a meme which we've all encountered is that UA-93 landed in Cleveland, that it did not crash in Shanksville, and that it did not get shot down. I don't know if UA-93 landed there or not, and it very well may have also. But the premise of this, or the point of this presentation, is to consider that UA-175, the original aircraft, likely landed in Cleveland at 10:10 in the morning of 9/11. So the clues for this, we have reports from newspapers in Ohio and the mayor of Ohio and other folks saying that a 767 from Boston was landed, that the mayor was extremely concerned about a flight 175, a Boeing 67. They mentioned that UA-93 had landed, that was the flight that landed. And so as I've looked into this, it's occurred to me that potentially 175 was landed in Cleveland under the name UA-93. This was done because UA-93 was a known hijack, and it was known that it was either going to be diverted somewhere or shot down. But that clearly this operation through Able Danger and other routes, if not purely MIHOP, was LIHOP, and clearly many of these actors were known before the day. So 93, a known hijack, we're waiting in the wings for them, so to speak. And so 175 lands, we landed under 93, and then later that can be reconciled. And I've got some great links to reports from personnel that worked at the airport, saying that there was, in fact, a aircraft that was moved to the NASA Center. It was a 767, and that it was curious, and nobody really knew who that aircraft was. The same website goes on to say that it was a KC-135 and that it was NASA personnel. I don't know that that's true. I don't know that the flight attendant's story is true, but it is useful for me in this presentation in considering that it was, in fact, a 767 that was in that hangar. That does correlate with the mayor's statement of a 767. It also messes with the mayor's statement that he was concerned about a flight 175. I believe that his concern for 175 was a concern for the actual UA-93, which was en route later. and that basically a little bit of misinformation or confusion on the ground at the time, they flipped up the call signals. It just allowed for that obfuscation to help everything be muddy. And I think that that obviously has kept all of us in the dark for a lot of years here. So if UA 175, tail number N612UA, landed in Cleveland at 1010, it could have been brought to the hangar. Then the Delta 1989 flight, another 767, could have been brought down shortly thereafter at 1030. Thus creating, nobody officially recognizes, by the way, two aircraft landing that day. That's, you have to dig on our quote-unquote conspiracy websites to find that. The official report is that there was only one aircraft that was brought down in a security landing that day. So we have one extra plane to account for. It is my thesis that that one extra plane is the original UA-175. With that, bearing that in mind, I go on in the PowerPoint to describe what I think probably did happen to the real UA-93. I think that that probably was shot down. That probably did happen somewhere in the vicinity of Shanksville. Clearly, it didn't hit in that crater that was a strip mine, you know, from the 1990s. But there was a lot of debris in the area, and there's been a lot of effort to, you know, to quarantine and contain that large area of Earth to this day. And as with any exercise, there's probably a point in time when the exercise needs to go live, and I'm sure after many decades of training our pilots to be able to shoot down an actual domestic flight that might have needed to really happen on that day for whatever reason. At any rate, so I think that's likely what happened to UA-93, but my thesis doesn't exclude UA-93 from also landing in Cleveland. I suppose that is possible. But I think that we have to, as a movement, consider the fact that the original UA-175 could not, by definition, have impacted the WTC-2 because of the radar speeds that are given. I think we have to trust all of those sources. I don't think it's fair to now go back and say, well, maybe the NTSB was wrong on that or whatnot. I think there's too much evidence saying that those were, in fact, the speeds reported and that is what happened. We have radar data from so many stations in the area. So it couldn't have flown that fast. It did. It can't be that plane. ACARS proved it was heading westward. Therefore, it was heading westward. So where did it go? And we have these reports of 767s being brought down in Cleveland, and I think that it is the likely explanation that it was, in fact, UA-175 that was brought down in Cleveland on 9/11, probably at 1010. I found a page, it might be through Rents or somewhere else, that I had previously thought was probably pretty legit, but it may be either a little misinformation or just confusion, and it's a good argument, but it talks about 1010 being, the 1010 flight being Flight 93, and then the 1030 flight being the 1989 flight. If we flip that around and say, okay, well, the 1010 flight was the Delta 1989 flight, and the 1030 flight was the UA-175 flight, I don't think the time quite works out. I think UA-175 would have been in the area of Cleveland before 1030, unless it was aloft in the air for some time, and I suppose that is also plausible. You know, the last thing I just want to point out here, we kind of talked about in the last book review, this food policy, and I know it's a common thing we talk about balkanizing the Middle East and fracturing our enemies and things like that, and I think that clearly that's happened in the truth movement a lot over the last decade, 15 years or so. And so we've seen friction between CIT and architects, and we've seen friction between pilots and architects, and I think that really the key to solving this mystery is to eliminate the friction, to not cast doubt on professional organizations that are made up of affiliates who are, in fact, experts in that in the particular realm, and to give their arguments the weight that they deserve. So that's it. I got the PowerPoint up, and, of course, I'm happy to get into this deeper with anybody online if they want, or answer questions now.
Okay, before we go there, can you send the link then to Craig for the PowerPoint so people can access that?
Yes, absolutely. And I am sorry for not having done that sooner. I sent it as an attachment to the... Craig, can you receive a 6 megabyte file?
Well, I got your PowerPoint today. I'm looking at it. So Yeah, so I should be good to include it.
I put it to the forum, but if you want to send it off to everybody via email, that'd be wonderful. The one other thing I want to talk about, Craig, you and I spoke in developing this plan and everything, and I'm critical of myself, too, and I want to be fair regarding that. So looking at the Rady's data and the returns heading westward, I want to be cautious before I stake the claim that a jet flew westward at a particular time or loci without myself having personally analyzed the Rady's data. And so I am presently working on getting the software to do that. I've gotten the FOIA released information from 911datasets.org, and I'm going to be working on that. So if I can further refine that for the group, I will.
Okay. Thanks for that. Does anybody have a quick question that they want to ask?
Yes.
Make a quick comment.
Tim Michael here.
Tim, you got to keep it very brief, okay?
Right. What is your name again? I didn't get it.
First name, Xander.
Xander?
Pronounced like a Z, and then you can call me an arena or an arena. I'm indifferent.
Okay. And what is your email address?
It is firstname.lastname@gmail.com.
First name?
X-A-N-D-E-R.
.ARENA.
Xander. .ARENA.
No, X-A-N-D-E-R.
Oh, X. Xander, okay. At Gmail. Okay, got it.
Okay. Thanks. Any other quick questions or comments?
Yes. Mike
Cook. Who?
Robin Cook. On the stack.
Martin Bruce on the stack.
Dan Hennen.
Jim.
Hold on. I guess we're going to get a stack here. I got Martin. I got who else?
Mike Cook.
Wayne.
Robin Cook.
James.
Who else?
Dan Hennen.
Dan. Who else?
Robin.
Yeah, I got you, Robin. All right. You gotta keep it to like 15-20 seconds. Just make your point real quick and give the inner a chance to respond because we're almost out of time on this. Martin,
I'll try to give a quick reply. Yeah.
Who's that?
Martin Bruce.
Okay, quick question. This may be well known, but I'm just gonna ask you because I don't know. Is there any chance that anybody could have messed with the data and sort of recreated it however they needed before the data was released under Freedom of Information? And is there anything on those tapes that lends any credence to the story that was on that probably bogus decoder files report that was given to a PDF that was sent to architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, and I think PONS for 9/11 Truth, that had a story of an AWACS plane circling over Baltimore, running planes, controlling the planes remotely flying into the towers?
I think that it's probably certainly possible that information could have been manipulated. I think that the Rady's, though, as I understand it, was garnered kind of by surprise and via backdoor. FAA had not wanted to release that sort of information, and I don't know exactly the methods that were used to get it, but it appears that the government kind of let it slip, so to speak. And there are two versions. There's the raw data, and then there's also the Air Force version, which includes all of the simulated flight sims from the worst Oregon scenarios that were going on that day. So there's two pieces of information to work with. Could it have been manipulated? Certainly. It's not out of my expertise, so I just don't know.
Yeah, the second part of this question, did you get that?
If you're familiar with the Dakota files, it's a 30-page document, and it had all kinds of detailed information about who implemented it, how that was done, and even to the fraction of a gram, different kinds of explosive charges on beams, and a lot of other stuff. I sent it to a former CIA guy I know who looked at it and said, someone put some time putting this together.
Okay, we got to keep it brief. Are you familiar with this, Xander?
Not familiar with it. I'll look
it
up.
It has an AWACS plane flying around Baltimore.
We're going to have to let that go for now, okay? That's
okay.
Not going to be something we can comment on.
Thanks,
Mike Cook, keep it very brief, please.
Yes, very brief. Since the entire buildings were rigged for demolition, it's not out of the question to figure that perhaps the impact sites were also rigged, which would help the image of the, you know, the planes coming in, just gliding into the steel and concrete. Xander, thank you so much for helping out with the foreign professional petition signers at AV. You kind of took that over for me because I've been busy with work, and thank you very much. I also think that all radar data should be suspect. They were inserting phantoms and all kinds of things, so just be careful of what you're looking at. You know, you don't know if you can trust it or not. Because
okay. Thank you, Mike. Okay.
I agree. Thanks, Mike.
James?
I'd just like to associate myself with Xander's recommendation that we respect the professionals who have associated with our movement, and as far as we can, I mean, there may be some plants and so on, but as far as we can, we need to respect them and all cooperate together to reach our goal.
Okay, thank you. Dan?
I'd like to say a good presentation there. I agree with a lot of that information. I'd like to stress also the importance of Stewart Air Force Base and what went on there. And overall, with the pilots for 9/11, good group, but keep an open mind. It's a highly infiltrated cage. A lot of truth out there, but just keep an open mind. It's pretty bad at the same time. But thank you for your presentation.
Okay, and Robin, if you could breathe.
Yeah, I will. I am familiar with equivalent airspeed. I did not bring it into this conversation, and it doesn't work in reverse down to high altitude. Number two, if there are any swaps, both the swap-in and swap-out aircraft have to have self radar capabilities, because the primary radar was turned on by all of the FAA air traffic controllers at that time. Number three, United 175 did a very close total analysis, and it is a Boeing 767-200. I did the measurements. Number three, four, worked with an Aussie, John Bursell, who's qualified electronics engineer but still had a chance to fly a Boeing 767 simulator, and he was able to easily fly at the speeds that we're talking about. And the reason that that's important is because that's the only little slip-up that Boeing has given us into sharing with us the flight test data, because Bursell was able to get the aircraft way up to that speed, and the aircraft kept on flying, and the only way that that background data would be working and be able to simulate reality was if there was reality in the flight test data.
That's all we have time for. You've gone on quite a late here. Do you want to make a quick response to the Xander, and then we need to close out because we're way over time on this?
Yeah, no problem. As I understand, the primary radar is the stealth thing. That's not the case. If two planes are overlapping, one on top of another, then potentially it might appear as a single blip. It depends on the resolution of the radar system. That might be the case. Also, of course, you did have all of those false radar signals going on with the military exercises, and so it might have been pretty easy to get two planes to be coincidental with one another and therefore, you know, make it mysterious. The other thing I just want to talk about is with the simulator, that is a simulator, and, you know, you can make anything happen in a simulator. We've seen WT-7 fall in a simulator, and clearly, you know, that's not real. But with a simulator, if you disengage the craft logic, then the plane is going to be impervious to structural failure, and yeah, you could fly it at that speed. You didn't mention that the video game go 1,000 miles an hour, and it might be fast enough to go left, right, thumb, but that doesn't mean that the tires would really be able to sustain that on the road. And the aircraft cannot sustain those speeds. Nor they can they get up to those speeds at 35,000 feet, and therefore they couldn't do them down at sea level.
Okay, I think we're going to have to stop it here, but I do think we have a potential for a technical debate here that the two of you could engage in at some point. If you were willing, we could possibly have an entire teleconference call on this issue. So something to consider, but we don't have time for further debate right now. So again, thank you, Xander, for your presentation, and we'll move on.
Thank you, Robin. Thanks for the
critique.
I'd be happy to debate that with you at some point in the future.
Okay.
It's automatic critique, but
so you
hope that we can put it on the mark.
Okay.
I'm in, Robin.
Okay. Well, the two of you might. Okay, I'll get in touch with both of you. We'll see what we can work out. Okay. All right. So let's see. We're down to item number 7. Which is Jonathan Mark. Jonathan, did you join us tonight? I don't think Jonathan's on the call, so I think we're gonna gain that time back, which is good. Because what time is it now? Oh yeah, we're already at time. So finally we have 5 minutes for David Schlesinger, and then 5 minutes for the people from A911 David, go ahead. David, are you on the call?
Yes, David, I am. I had it on mute.
Okay.
I acted last time like I listed people who supported me. I never did. What I did was list people who had attended enough weekly AE calls so that they would understand the struggle over whether qualified people should be given relevant lists to call from. That short list even included Andy. Andy accused me of ad hominem attacks, which is not true. He used vague ad hominem attacks against me, however. I did criticize various people for specific actions, which is not the same as ad hominem attacks. I noted that Kelly David resisted Richard Gage's orders to provide Wayne Costi full access to the signer database while he was still on the AE board. Richard accepted her justification that she just didn't like Wayne. I would think that should be a cause for concern. I'd like people to get back to me on whether they agree. I do call for the firing of all paid staff, but did not do that on that call. There used to be 20 national teams. Now there are 6. The current paid staff support policies hostile to volunteers. Even if all qualified organizers were allowed to receive lists to call from, the current paid staff could easily not provide legitimate lists to anyone they don't like. It is notable that Samantha Liberty recently used the 9/11 Truth Movement Facebook page to try to recruit people since she is not allowed to call the newest petition signers as I used to. I'm even the person who got Richard to agree that Samantha's local group be given local contact for new signers regularly. Andy asserted I made misrepresentations and falsehoods but didn't provide a shred of evidence. Well, I'm pleased they have already backtracked on their policy to give out lists to a local organizer, David Fuhrer. This still leaves all the other local organizers hanging. Andy did not address the issue I raised that people respond much better to recruiting phone calls than to recruiting emails. Since he never addressed this issue directly, AE seems to agree they have chosen a weak recruitment policy. Here's a good example of why calling is stronger than emailing to recruit volunteers. John Metters was team leader for outreach to law enforcement. His list was over 100 people. He emailed them to start a team, but only one person responded. I advised him to call them. He got enough people to have a regular call for months. Andy did raise on this matter was an excuse to protect signers from calls recruiting them to outside projects, which has not been a problem for many years. Recently, one group included a sentence mentioning a Chris Bolin talk. It wasn't the focus of the email. It was just one sentence. Since local groups have recently been told they can branch out, this one instance is much more appropriately dealt with by just making a list of what is off limits. I challenge AE to give one other instance in 10 years where the list was abused. Allow me to give background on Andy. I gave up my $300 a month stipend for at least 2 months so Andy could pay the original network he used to start his podcast, Freefall. Doesn't seem he appreciated that. I also am who called for him to be allowed to call new petition signers to get people to call into C-SPAN to challenge calls over WTC7. That eventually got Richard interviewed by C-SPAN, a great accomplishment. Let me give you more background on Andy. He organized a mass fax to police chiefs across the U.S. and even paid for part of it. Less than 10 responded. His current project is mailing the excellent booklet Beyond Misinformation to well-credentialed scientists and engineers. My question for you folks is, what percentage of such people are likely to read such unsolicited email? One time on Free Fall, he spoke against caring what Noam Chomsky says. Of course we, as truthers, do not wait on Chomsky's every word because he is the ultimate left gatekeeper. It is reasonable for truthers who come from the left to try to reach out to various left gatekeepers in hopes of showing them how they are being hypocritical. I did challenge my former professor Chomsky to debate, not so I could change his mind, but so I could show how easy it is to expose his thinking on 9/11. There's nothing wrong with libertarians like Andy to not worry about liberals and leftists. It is an error, however, to discourage truthers who come from the left to denigrate efforts by those truthers to show left gatekeepers how they are being hypocritical. I believe that's a little less than five.
Yeah, you kept it under time. Thank you, Dave. Okay, I guess we need to give the same amount of time, which would be 4.5 minutes, to the folks from that video, 9/11 too. So the floor is yours. Go ahead.
Okay, I was trying to write down all the things that Dave was rapid-firing out there. So I'm just going to start off with the same thing that I said last time, reiterate there is no issue here. People who have specific project ideas need to call petition signers for whatever the project entails can still do it. A lot of this is stemming off of the fact that the local action groups spun off into their own groups on their own decision because they were talking about things that are interesting, and I mean, I care about too, but they have nothing to do with the science evidence of World Trade Center demolitions in New York. So they wanted to do their own thing, and they agreed that they can't have people inviting somebody to a group that talks about outside things when somebody just signed the AE petition. Dave doesn't like that. That's fine. Dave doesn't make that decision. We do. Dave doesn't have a volunteer here anymore. They're not liking Wayne Star. I'm not familiar with that whole story, but he's exaggerating it from what and I'll let Kelly handle that in just a moment. The 20 national teams only existed mainly in Dave's head. When I came here, there were only a few teams left, and a lot of them were just had just team leaders on them. So we reoriented, and we essentially put the teams to work. So instead of Dave's old strategy of having people sit around and talk about projects, and then maybe it gets done, maybe it doesn't, maybe there's people who have time to do it, maybe there aren't a lot of people with good ideas. We actually have specific project ideas that we tell them to do when they come here, and they get to it, and they're doing it right now. So there's always a project getting done now, as opposed to in the past when there was not many projects getting done. But if somebody's got a specific project idea, we're always willing to do it. John Freedom came on the call last Thursday and wanted to do outreach to the police. So, and we're helping him out with that. He's doing the research for it, and, if he needs to call petition signers for that for some reason, we'll figure it out, and if it sounds good, then we'll give it to him. So there's no issue here. I mean, Dave is on this crusade over some perceived problem that only exists to him alone. Even the people that he claims to be championing don't support him on this. Samantha doing outreach on Facebook is for CAP, not for AE. She's fine with that. I talked to her about that. And she said she was fine. Misrepresenting. Well, he was asking about attacks and anything that he misrepresented. In the last call, Dave mentioned something about AE actually killing somebody. Okay, that's crazy. That's not what happened. Somebody who was on the team briefly committed suicide because she had some personal problems that had absolutely nothing to do with AE work, but in his anger over being kicked out, Dave has around and used it as some kind of baseless accusation against good people. And, so that's why I brought that up. With regard to the Chomsky thing, on my own show, it's my show, and I'm expressing an opinion. Now, if Dave doesn't like my opinion, he can blog about it, or he can create his own show and express his own opinion on it. So that's really all I have to say to that. I'm going to turn it over to Kelly.
Okay, Kelly, you got about a minute and a half. Go ahead.
I'll be real quick. Andy pretty much summed that up. As I'll just mention that situation that he brought up about Wayne, Dave Schlesinger came onto our board call and was not happy with the new procedures we had and threatened the board and told us that he was going to contact everybody that he had in his phone and that he was going to bring the organization down. The biggest reason he was upset was because he didn't have access to all of the lists. And about a week or so later, Wayne told Richard that he came up with a way to give Dave the entire list. And under the chairman of the board at the time's orders, Robert McCoy, I was told to turn off Wayne's access. It had nothing to do with not liking Wayne, or I don't even know where that story came from. I like Wayne a lot, but when someone comes onto our board meetings and tells us they're going to bring the organization down, I'm not going to then give him access to every single one of our supporters. That's all I have to say.
Okay. Well, thank you all for respecting the time limits, and that's all we have time for tonight. It's time now for announcements.
Can I ask one question really quick? Robin Borden,
If we start this, then everybody will have an opportunity. We don't have time. We're out of time on this.
Okay,
if people want to pursue this, we can put it on the agenda for next time, okay?
I tried the email. It doesn't work.
I'm sorry?
H-O-R-D-O-N. It's not Borden, it's H-O-R-D-O-N.
Oh, D-O-N. Okay, thank you.
Right.
Okay, there we go. All right. So it's time now for announcements, and the first announcement comes from Barbara Honegger, who could not join us tonight because of her newfound political responsibilities. Barbara has qualified for the ballot as a congresswoman in California in the primary, and that's what she's now pursuing. She wants everybody to be aware of that. She's running, she says, as a Bernie Sanders independent. So I hope we all wish her well, and anybody in California that wishes may want to contact her to see what they can do to help out with her 9/11 Truth Friendly campaign. Who else has an announcement? I know that Barry had something. Barry, I guess you're next. Go ahead.
Okay, great. You'll be relieved, everybody, that I will be quite brief, and there's nothing theoretical and nothing controversial. So to set up the short time I have, I'll just mention two things. For those at their computers who can access the website, you could enter in your browser Modern Knowledge, one word, modernknowledge.ca. And on the home page, you'll see the name Ken O'Keefe. Second thing is, I'm the organizer for the visit of Ken O'Keefe to Toronto at the end of April. And then to proceed to start, I have two easy questions for everybody, and the answers help me just to know how to proceed. And partly based on these answers, I'll just give a very brief report, and finally I'm going to seek advice from anyone who has it. I believe there's about 25 of us. So with both my questions, to indicate that you want to answer yes, just sort of give your first name and pause. I'll try to count how many there are. Ken O'Keefe, how many know his name?
Robin. Dan.
Yes.
Carol.
Ken.
Greg, yes.
Of course.
Xander.
David, yes.
Wilt.
Okay, good. That sounds like 8 or 9.
Peter, yes.
10? Sure, 10, sort of, which is almost half of the people. And then the second question, which is really easy, and that's for those who have some idea of who Ken O'Keefe is. How many, just first name again, know he's currently on a 16-city tour?
Good.
Mike. Cheryl.
Craig.
Good. Okay, people who know him know he's on the tour. So for the other people, I have 100 words, which I just wrote for a local website of one of the venues where he's going to be speaking in Toronto on April 28th. O'Keefe is unusually true to his values and vision. An ex-U.S. Marine and Gulf War veteran, he renounced his U.S. citizenship out of disgust at the American Empire's carnage. He was a founding member of the Human Shield Action in Iraq in 2003. He served as captain on the first Free Gaza mission, 2008, and he survived the Israeli attack on the ship Mavi Marmara in 2010. His overarching goal is to promote realistic world citizenship, and he really walks the walk because he renounced his American citizenship. So my question then is, anybody who knows him, anybody who heard this little brief announcement, do you have any advice right now, or I can give you my simple email address later if you want it, any advice as to how we should proceed in Toronto. We're well rolling along. We've got our venues. We've got a website, which I gave you. But anybody got any advice for us, what we should try to do? Should we try to Canadianize him? Should we try to tone him down, or what?
Don't tone him down.
Right, okay.
Late in, Jonathan Mark calling.
Uh-oh.
Okay, I was late, so I'd be glad to just listen.
Jonathan, can we defer your... We're going to have to defer your issue until next month, I'm afraid, because we're already out of time, okay?
No problem.
Okay.
I have an announcement. Yeah.
Robin, Barry still has
the floor. I'm sorry, yeah. Is that the end of the advice? Or any other advice?
Robin, with advice.
Okay.
Okay, Barry, first of all, Canadian humor, exactly hilarious. You actually put into one paragraph that you were going to not talk about anything controversial, yet you are Barry's liquor, and you did talk about, okay, Tennessee. Okay, so you may be an old dude, but you got some stuff hanging there, baby.
I see guilty. Or is
anyway,
what
Barry,
Ken would say, that's fucking true.
Barry, I would internationalize him. No matter what you do, internationalize him.
Okay.
That's all.
Excellent. I'm totally happy with this advice. Very brief, but very helpful. Thanks a lot, everybody.
Question, Barry.
Okay.
Is there a place where we can know his schedule?
I guess yes and no. Why don't you email me? And I'm going to give you my email address. It's so simple. It's my three initials, which is in the aviation alphabet, Bravo Whiskey Zulu. But just the letters, BravoWhiskeyZulu@bell.net. And I'll get the schedule to you.
Thank you.
Sure thing.
Okay. Thank you, Barry.
Okay.
Any other announcements before we
get Messenger.
Announcement.
Okay, Dave and then Bill. Go ahead, Dave.
And then Craig.
Yes,
you missed Barton.
Okay, so Dave, hold on. We got Dave, who else did I say?
Bill Wilson, Bruce.
Barton Bruce, and then
Craig.
Okay.
Got
to keep it brief, folks. We're way past time. Go ahead, Dave.
Yes, I have applied to the Journal of 9/11 Studies to write a peer-reviewed letter, not article, on the problem of the restraint of giving out lists to AEs, giving out lists to call from, because it still is, even if it's true that you can do it for national teams, which is wonderful, it's still relevant to the grassroots organizing, and I'm just seeking anybody else who wants to help me work on that paper.
Okay. Bill?
Okay. So Massachusetts is unique among the 50 states in that it has, you can write this down, the right of free petition, which allows a citizen of Massachusetts to write statutes, submit them to their state legislators, and the legislator must submit it to the legislature as a whole. In Massachusetts, it's called the General Court. So I am writing a statute for a Massachusetts Board of 9/11 inquiry to be submitted in the next couple of weeks. And anyone else who is A, in Massachusetts, or two, would like to have a law passed, can send a note to me at BillWilt@rcn.com, and I'll work with you about it. This is a really strange kind of thing. It doesn't, when you submit the legislation, it becomes just another bill. There are 4,000 submitted every 2 years. On the other hand, it's connected to the whole legislative process, the capital correspondence from radio, TV, and print, et cetera, et cetera. It's a very interesting opportunity. It's a It's a constitutional right in the Massachusetts state constitution, which means you can't get rid of it without constitutional amendment. So it's a pretty interesting piece of legislation.
Your last name is spelled W-I-L-T-S?
Four letters. Bill, W-I-L-T, at RCN.
Bill Wills, at RC?
RCN, Roger Charlie Nancy, dot com.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Bill. And let's see. That would bring up Barton.
Okay. Talking about Ken O'Keefe, he'll be here in Boston on the April 12th. We thought we were originally going to have him 10, 11, and 12. We're running around finding three venues. It wasn't really Boston 9/11, although we're involved, which Bill Will was involved too. But it was actually the two people who founded Boston 9/11, Joe Lepizzi and Kathleen Sheridan, who have been doing their own little things behind the scenes all these years, and have not actively been at our meetings. But in any case, he's going to be here April 12th at 7 to 9 p.m. at the Harvard Epworth Methodist Church, which is the only church in the huge block that Harvard Law School is in that doesn't belong to Harvard, at 155 Mass Ave, Cambridge. It's just a few feet, you know, easy walk, 2-minute walk out of Harvard Square. Free donations welcome and all the usual stuff.
Okay. Thank you, Martin. And Craig.
Yeah, just real quick, we had planned a debate involving myself and Adam Ruff and Barbara Honegger for April 27th, and we've bumped that back a month, mainly at my request, just for time reasons. So I just wanted to let everybody know so that they would know that they could offer up all their agenda items for next month's meeting without worrying that it was going to mostly be taken up with a debate. So the plan is to do that in the May call.
What's the latest on two meetings per month?
Well, we will use two meetings per month if we need them, okay? There will be a second meeting on the second Wednesday if we have overflow agenda. At the moment, we don't, but it's happened in the past already that we've had more than enough for one call, so that's why we need that opportunity if we need it. Craig, thanks for saving me that work. I was just about to make the same announcement, but it is the case then that you and Sheila will be presenting next month, then, correct, in April?
If you want us to do that, I'm sure that we can
do that. Yeah, we need to start filling up that agenda because at the moment that agenda is open. So,
can I make an announcement? This is Cheryl. I have just a quick announcement, if I could.
Yes, sure, Cheryl. Go ahead.
Kat McGuire and I have put together, and a few other people have put together, six panels for the Left Forum, which is in New York in May. And we haven't heard through, we've submitted them and we're waiting for approval, but we're doing one on 9/11, we're doing one on false flags, assassinations, the global war on terror, Islamophobia, and COINTELPRO. So I just want people to know that we're hoping they'll get approved, and we've got really good speakers and everything. So, and that's May 20th through the 22nd in New York.
Thank you. Okay.
Is Ken O'Keefe coming to New York? Yeah, Ken O'Keefe's going to be in New York. He is indeed. And
when?
I have to just go to. I just hope I can find it really fast while you're all just breathing.
Okay. All right. Well, you skip to that. Does anybody else have an announcement? I thought somebody else said they had an announcement.
Yeah, it was Wilt. I forgot to say I'm running for Congress in the 5th Congressional District, Massachusetts, as a write-in candidate. So that's a write-in in November, no primaries.
Okay.
Okay. I found Ken O'Keefe supposed to be in New York City April 14 through 17.
Where?
Oh, don't know. If you, again, email me, BravoWhiskeyZulu@bell.net.
Bell.net?
Correct, yeah, like Bell Telephone. BWZ, as we say in Canada, @bell.net. I won't go into rigmarole. I should be able to find out where he will be in New York City.
It's just itinerary online anywhere, Barry?
Yes, it's on multiple places.
If you could send us a link so people could access it from the minutes, I think that would be very helpful. Can you do that? Send
I shall do that. I shall send a link just as fast as possible. Absolutely.
Great.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much. Okay. Any other announcements before we close?
Barton, one sentence to go add.
I'm sorry?
Barton wants to add one sentence.
Barton.
If you haven't already seen it and you don't know about 3 years right after or before the annual APAC meeting, this year's was actually before it by a couple of days, and it was streamed this time live on YouTube, and then it's been edited and fixed up, but it's still there, all 8 hours plus of it. A lot of experts speaking from Israel and from the United States, but the title this year was Israel's S with a plural, Israel'sInfluence.org. The previous one was IsraelLobbyUS.org, and the first one was NatSummit.org. All have absolutely subject matter experts talking about the absolute control they own our media, they own half of Congress or more of it, and people like Gideon Levy from Haaretz basically saying that, you know, it's insane and what goes on is bad, and it needs to be fixed not only for United States public safety and respect in the world, but also for Israel, because, I've said more than I should. But there's a vast amount of information there, and if you think they're the ones who did 9/11, these are some of the solutions that have to be, what these people are saying are things that are relevant to fixing it.
Thank you. Okay. Any other announcements?
Well, 3 years, 3 years.
Yeah, any other announcements?
Something
else. Only one short. Okay, so hearing no more requests for announcements.
Wayne, can you hear me?
Wayne, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to announce that we have been doing some research into the CIPCO security camera videos approaching the Pentagon. And what we've identified is there is actually a shadow that has been captured. We have an article up on our website, 911truthoutreach.org, that goes through this, and there is a history. It was discussed almost 10 years ago when the videos were released, and it seems to have faded out from memory, but please check out the article on our 911truthoutreach.org website about the Pentagon shadow. It's really interesting, and I'd like to actually put this on the agenda for next month. Thanks.
All right. In the meantime, if you want to send the link to Craig, we can put it in the minutes for people's reference, okay?
I can do that. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Any other announcements? Okay. Well, thank you all for your cooperation tonight and for a very fairly lengthy teleconference. And we'll be back April the 27th. And we have a fairly open agenda, so if you have agenda items, be sure to submit them well in advance of the deadline. And we'll look forward to another teleconference at that time. Have a good evening, and thank you again. Good night.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night, everybody.
Bye.